Hello and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. This one is entitled The Comfort of Judgment, and it focuses on Hebrews chapter 10, verses 26 to 31. Now, I'm going to read this passage, but as I read this passage, I want you to consider a question. How do these words make you feel? What do you feel when I read these words that are found in Hebrews 10, verses 26 to 31? Because the author writes these words. For if we willfully persist in sin after having received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful prospect of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. Anyone who has violated the law of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by those who have spurned the Son of God, profaned the blood of the covenant by which they were sanctified, and outraged the Spirit of grace? For we know the one who said, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay," and again, "The Lord will judge his people." It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. How do these words make you feel? Because we read these words on Saturday at Paradox, and a few people said words like this. They said, "I don't want to love this God." Another person said, "Yes, these words make me feel terrified." Another person said, "These words bring fear in my heart." Hebrews chapter 10, verses 26 to 31 is a fearful passage. But what I would like to do during this podcast is talk to you about how I have found this paragraph, yes, this fearful paragraph, to be entirely good news. And in order to understand that, we have to first talk about the Bible. Now, the Bible is composed of 66 different books. And while these books are often read and lumped and bound together, it's important for us to know that the authors of these 66 books didn't intend for this to happen. They didn't mean for you to read the Bible from beginning to end, because usually the Bible was connected and brought together after they had lived, breathed, and died. However, the authors behind these 66 books did intend for you to read the book that they wrote in its entirety. This is important because if you pull out one passage from one paragraph in one different book, you can actually say something that is completely counter to what the author intended and completely miss the point. We call this pulling an idea out of context, and context is very important in 2017, isn't it? Context is important because our head of state currently communicates with the nation 280 characters at a time over Twitter. So it's important for us to understand context because it's real possible for us to read tweets out of context. And when we look up the word context in the dictionary, the definition is this: the circumstances that form the setting for an event, statement, or idea, and in terms of which it can be fully understood and assessed. Now, the context of Hebrews chapter 10, verses 26 to 31 is important, because if you've been with us the last 2 weeks, you know that we are going through the book of Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 1, the author is very concerned with establishing the divinity of Christ. The author wants any reader to know that Jesus is in fact the Son of God. And throughout this work, he reiterates that this is important because if this is true, if Jesus is in fact the Son of God, then it changes everything. Specifically, if Jesus is the Son of God, then to be human is to be good. Then from Hebrews chapter 2 all the way to Hebrews chapter 10, there is this metaphor that is talked about again and again, and we talked about this last week. The metaphor is that Jesus is our high priest. And the author writes about the importance of Jesus being our high priest because he is saying to us that Jesus as our high priest affirms the goodness of the universe. And so for the first 10 chapters of the book of Hebrews, and there's only 13 chapters, for the first 10 chapters, the author is reiterating over and over again to the reader, your existence is good. He is affirming the goodness of creation, the goodness of humanity, and the goodness of being alive. So when we read the entire book of Hebrews, as the author intended, we get this overwhelming sense that the dominant pejorative theme of Hebrews is in fact good news. Because this author wants to say, because Jesus has walked among us and Jesus lives today, we can know that our humanity and our existence is in fact good. And so when we come to this paragraph that is filled with fear in Hebrews chapter 10, we have to understand that this is one small paragraph in chapters and a whole book that is telling us it is a good thing to be alive. Now, what's really interesting about this is it's possible to read through 10 chapters of an author telling you that you are a good human being and to be a human is good. But to come across this paragraph that's filled with God's judgment and fear and anxiety and focus just on that chapter, focus just on that passage that is filled with fear. And the question is, why do we do that? Well, biologists tell us that we are hardwired to believe that fear is the most important thing. And the reason for this is because if you see a butterfly that is beautiful, typically we will stop and appreciate the beauty of the butterfly. And the beauty of the butterfly is a good gift for you as you take in the beauty of God's creation. However, if that same butterfly flies past you as a bus is barreling toward you, your brain is going to default toward fear, and you are going to get out of the way of the bus because that is a survival tactic that we have within us. Our brain is hardwired to default toward fear. And it's as if the author of Hebrews knows this. And it's almost like the entire writing of Hebrews is to try and get people to live at a level that is above fear, to say you can trust the goodness of the universe. And the ironic part of all this is the fact that there's one tiny paragraph in a much larger discussion that is negative, and we tend to give way too much weight to that negative, fearful paragraph. It takes faith and it takes trust to believe that the dominant theme of Hebrews is in fact good news. Which brings us to the passage itself. Now in Hebrews 10 verse 26, the first line of that passage, the author writes, "For if we willfully persist in sin after having received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins." Now at this point, it's important for us to recognize once again the context of this discussion. Because it's fair to ask the question about sin, what sin are we talking about? When the author writes, "For if we willfully persist in sin," it's worthwhile knowing whether he's talking about sin in general or specific sins. And if you read the paragraph before this paragraph that's filled with fear, you find that the author is talking about specific sins. In Hebrews chapter 10, verse 19 to 25, the author writes this, "Therefore, my friends, since we have confidence to enter the sanctuary by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain that is through his flesh, and since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us approach with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast to the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who has promised is faithful. And let us consider how to provoke one another to love and good deeds, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching." What sin are we talking about? What sin frames the discussion for that paragraph filled with fear? The author is talking about the sin of the Christian who is unable to practice faith, hope, and love. We then get to that paragraph filled with fear, and if you read the paragraph after that paragraph, you find a very interesting discussion that keeps this idea of sin and an inability for Christian to practice something. Hebrews 10, 32 to 36 reads this, "But recall those earlier days when, after you had been enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to abuse and persecution, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. For you had compassion for those who were in prison, and you cheerfully accepted the plundering of your possessions, knowing that you yourselves possess something better and more lasting. Do not, therefore, abandon that confidence of yours. It brings a great reward. For you need endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised." If you look about halfway through that paragraph, the author writes to this Christian community, "For you had compassion." In other words, this Christian community, this church, used to practice compassion and visit those in need, and now they were no longer doing that. And so the author writes this group that has ceased to practice compassion. And when you ask the question, what sin are we talking about? The sin that this author is talking about is the inability to practice compassion. Now, compassion is an interesting word because it derives from the Latin word compassio. And the Latin word compassio literally translates to this: to suffer alongside, to be with the person in the midst of their suffering, to help those who are in need, is to be a compassionate person. Which is interesting because just a couple months ago, there was a whole city that was in need. The city I'm speaking about is the city of Houston, who was hit by Hurricane Harvey. And it was a devastating flood, and it was terrible, and the numbers were just shocking and appalling, and all sorts of Americans were displaced from their homes because water had filled up their homes and they had nowhere to go. Immediately, a religious leader in the area, a man named MJ Khan, saw the people in need and immediately opened up his religious facilities. People were shocked by the generosity of MJ Khan's religious facilities, and they said, "How is it that you're so willing to help these people in need when you have no idea who they were?" And in an interview with the Washington Post, he responded to that question by saying this. He said, "Look, helping is a total no-brainer. You don't even have to discuss or debate helping another person. It's part of our faith and part of being human. I always feel that this is why God created human beings, for us to help each other." In other words, MJ Khan says, compassion is not up for debate. If we as a community refuse to practice compassion like that community in the book of Hebrews, then we have in fact sinned. Now at this point, you may think to yourself, wow, MJ Khan is a fantastic Christian. To which I would say, hold on a minute. He's not Christian. He's Muslim. And he is the president of the Islamic Society of Greater Houston. And as soon as Hurricane Harvey descended upon Houston, he and the other Muslims of Houston opened up their mosques, and at least 25 mosques opened their doors to refugees in need of shelter. This is an amazing testimony to how people understand God through the lens of compassion. But what I did not understand until recently was that when the hurricane hit Houston, on August 25, it immediately caused a problem for Muslims that opened their mosques. Specifically, on September 1 of this year was the celebration of one of their holiest festivals within the Islamic calendar. The festival is called the Eid al-Adha Festival, and it commemorates the faithfulness and obedience of Abraham as he was willing to sacrifice his own son. Now, my understanding is that this is the most important globally celebrated Muslim holiday on the calendar. And the Washington Post knew this, so they went and interviewed him again, and they asked him about, well, what's going to happen to these refugees when the Eid al-Adha festival comes along in just a few days? And MJ Khan responded immediately by saying, well, the refugees are the number one priority. They will not be disturbed. They will not be displaced. They will not be moved. If the Muslims who come to the Eid al-Adha festival have to pray in the parking lot, guess what? They'll pray in the parking lot. And to me, his interview and the actions of the Islamic community of Houston was just, man, it's just eye-opening, because it was such a clear priority on the importance of compassion within a faith community. And especially when you compare and contrast it with Christian communities who repeatedly close their doors to refugees who are seeking shelter from the storm. In fact, some of the largest churches in America are in Houston, and they fell under scrutiny for not opening their doors to refugees as soon as the hurricane hit. And their response was something like this: well, the city never asked us to open our doors. Or something like this, where they said, well, the shelters aren't full, so why wouldn't they just go there? In other words, they were depending on the city to be more compassionate than the church. And the Christian churches within Houston received an enormous amount of social media backlash, as I think they should have, because they refused to practice compassion. And social media and the American public really judged harshly these prominent Christian churches because they didn't really seem interested in compassion. They seemed more interested in protecting their own facilities and their own liabilities. Now, I don't know if you were like me, but when I heard about Christian communities that close their doors to people seeking shelter, it made me my blood boil. I was so frustrated, and I was hoping that Christian leaders would come and condemn this kind of behavior. And what I was shocked to find out is when I read the book of Hebrews is that there's already been a judgmental written word against Christians who refuse to practice compassion. The author of Hebrews says that this is the greatest sin a Christian can do, is refuse to help other people in need, namely refugees seeking shelter from a storm. And if you were in charge of this church, and you found out that your church refused to help refugees from the storm, what kind of words would you use to address this Christian community that refused to practice Christian compassion? Would you use words like this? Would you say, well, that's okay. I mean, we're all God's children. Would you use words that said like, look, I understand that you made a mistake, but are you sorry? Because if you're sorry, we can move on. Or would you use words that were rather harsh? Would you use words that said, you know, you can't not take in these refugees. You can't not practice compassion. You have to practice compassion because that's what the whole thing of Christianity is. And so because of this, you have this community thousands of years ago, and part of the challenge of Hebrews is we don't know who the author is and we don't know who the intended audience is. But it's possible, looking at what happened in Houston, to imagine a situation where Christians were surrounded by people who were suffering and they refused to help them. And if you were that pastor writing words to this Christian community who refused to help those who were suffering, what words would you use to rebuke them? The author uses these words in that paragraph that is filled with fear. Hebrews 10:28 reads this: anyone who has violated the law of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by those who have spurned the Son of God, profaned the blood of the covenant by which they were sanctified, and outraged the Spirit of grace? In other words, it is a punishment to be a Christian church who does not prioritize compassion. It is entirely possible for us in 2017 to imagine a Christian community who deserved these words from their pastor, who deserved to be told that they have spurned the word of God when they refuse to practice compassion. And these harsh words, my brothers and sisters, are good news because it allows us to stand up and call out other Christian communities and our own Christian communities when we do not prioritize compassion. I've got to tell you, as a pastor of Paradox, when I read this story about Houston churches turning their back on refugees and I read this passage in Hebrews, I often think about myself and how I've refused to practice or prioritize compassion. And I've been convinced that religion is about other things. Christianity specifically is about other things. And I have to call out my own BS and my own hypocrisy and say, Craig, there's times that you've missed it. And that is simply unacceptable. It's time to let that go and return to the priority of compassion within the Christian tradition. This paragraph is good news because it calls us back to what's important within Christianity, namely the fruit of the Spirit that is compassion. Which brings us back to the first part of that paragraph, where we read these words, "For if we willfully persist in sin after having received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful prospect of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries." Now, these two verses, taken out of context, lead to a very strange place. And to give you an idea of what this strange place is, I'm going to tell you a story that involves two people I went to high school with. Now, one of these people was a woman and one was a man, and we're not going to use their real names. So the woman's name we'll call Susie and the man's name we'll call Steve. So Susie and Steve went to high school with me, and Susie and Steve were both involved in church leadership. Like, they were student leaders, they were good kids, and they would often testify or lead Bible studies and talk about how God had been good in their lives and how much they loved Jesus. So anyways, Steve and Susie graduate. They're in the same class. They go to different colleges, and Steve goes to a private Christian college, and Susie goes to a public university. About a year later, Susie starts posting pictures of parties she's attended online where there's alcohol and other substances. Steve sees these pictures online and he writes an email to Susie telling her that she shouldn't be practicing those things. And he specifically quotes Hebrews chapter 10, verses 26 and 27 that we just read. Now, Susie gets this email, and Susie is the one who's told me this story. And Susie tells me that she's immediately defensive. Who is Steve and why does he get to tell her what is and what isn't Christian? And so she writes back a bunch of things, telling him off essentially and saying like, look, just because I have some lifestyle choices that are different than yours doesn't mean that I don't have a relationship with Jesus. And Steve wrote back once again, citing this passage, and he said, you don't understand, I'm trying to help you because when you walk away from God as a Christian, you're really messing with some dangerous stuff. And then he says these words in this email. He says, it's much worse for you, Susie, because you were a Christian before. But if you weren't a Christian before, Susie, then you'd be okay because, you know, I think that God's a God of grace. And she said, what do you mean? And he says, well, if you willfully persist in sin after having received the truth, and he says, you've received the truth and you've walked away from it. And the truth is, Susie, God will judge you more harshly because you walked away. So Steve reads this passage in Hebrews, and he walks away with this understanding that God raises the standards of salvation for people who are Christian. To give you this in a metaphor, Steve viewed salvation similar to a pole vault competition. Now, the pole vault is a crazy sport that I love to watch during the Olympics. And I don't know how you come up with a sport where you run with a stick, a bendy stick at a hole in the ground. You jam the stick in the hole and then you rise up above another pole and you try and get over that. And whoever gets over the highest one wins. And the way the competitions work, I think most of you know this, but the idea is that they keep raising the bar and whoever can clear the highest height where other people fail is the champion of the pole vault for that track meet. And so the way that Steve was viewing salvation with this passage was that if you're not a Christian, God sets the bar at salvation at like 4 or 5 feet. But if you are a Christian, then God raises the bar for salvation and sets it at like 10 or 11 or 12 feet. And you've got to clear a much higher gap because you have been living in the truth. Which raises the question, does God in fact raise the bar for Christians seeking salvation? Does God hold Christians to higher standards than non-Christians for eternal life? And I'd like to tell you the answer during this podcast. And the answer is this. Of course not. Of course not. And you may ask me how I know the answer is of course not. And I'm not going to cite any Bible verses. I'm going to simply use logic. Because if it's true that God holds Christians to a higher standard of salvation than non-Christians, and that same God asks us to love people who are Christian and non-Christian, then logically, every Christian everywhere should stop telling other people about Jesus. Why? Because it's too dangerous to tell them about Jesus because you are risking their eternal salvation. They are much better off if you never mention the word or name Jesus around them. And this theology, this pole vaulting, raising the bar theology that people take from Hebrews chapter 10 is ripped out of context. And this idea that God makes things harder for you because you're a Christian is just logically implausible. There's no way God would operate that way. And if God did operate that way, we'd all have to stop talking about Jesus right now. I'm pretty sure that's not what God is going for. Now, at this point, you could go back to Hebrews chapter 10, verse 26 and say, come on, Craig, it says, for if we willfully persist in sin after having received the knowledge of the truth, that clearly talks about God who raises the bar. I would say, oh, no, no, no. It talks about something much better than that. It talks about developing human consciousness. And to illustrate developing human consciousness, I want to talk about Uma Thurman and her Instagram post. Uma Thurman is one of Hollywood's premier actresses. And on Thanksgiving Day, she posted these words, Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Which is just a nice post, right? I love it when Uma Thurman wishes me a happy Thanksgiving. But when you read closer as to what Uma Thurman is saying, you realize that this is not your typical holiday greeting. Because on Thanksgiving Day, she said, Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. except you, Harvey, and all your wicked conspirators. I'm glad it's going slowly. You don't deserve a bullet. Stay tuned, Uma Thurman. And then she tagged it with the hashtag #MeToo. Now, Uma Thurman has worked on numerous projects with the producer Harvey Weinstein. Now, Harvey Weinstein has been in the news a lot lately, and it all started with a New York Times article that exposed that this producer, a powerful man in Hollywood, has a pattern of exploiting women he employs and demanding sex from them in exchange for roles in major motion pictures. And the New York Times article revealed that Harvey Weinstein and the Weinstein Company, which he founded, that produces several movies in America, has settled 8 different cases out of court of sexual harassment and allegations. And Harvey Weinstein would do this pattern, that he has this behavior of doing this thing over and over again, where he invites a lead actress to his room, to his hotel room. And when he invites her, he says, like, hey, we got to talk about some work things, and I'd love for you to come up and talk about the role in the movie. And so this woman that he employs goes up to his hotel room. And when they get there for a work meeting, Harvey Weinstein answers the door in a bathrobe, invites them in, talks a little bit about work, and then invites them to participate in some sort of sexual favor or act. Now, when I read Ashley Judd's story about what happened to her with Harvey Weinstein, it broke my heart because it's just so horrific, because she says that she went up to Harvey Weinstein's room to discuss work. He answered the door in a bathrobe, invited her in, and then said these words to her. He said, "Can I give you a massage, or do you want to watch me shower?" And Ashley Judd describes this to the reporter. She says, "In my head, I'm thinking, how do I get out of this room as quickly as possible and at the same time not alienate Harvey Weinstein?" Because she knew that Harvey Weinstein held the keys to her future and current employment. As part of its reporting then, the New York Times reached out to Harvey Weinstein and asked him for a statement. The very first line of that statement was this. He said, "Look, I came of age in the 60s and 70s when all the rules about behavior and workplaces were different. That was the culture then." And the rest of his statement to the New York Times was essentially saying, like, yeah, I know it's wrong, but where I came from, it wasn't wrong. And so Harvey Weinstein is basically saying there's the past, there's 2017 or the present, and then there's the future. And I came along in the 60s and 70s, and he's basically telling the public, he says, look, I'm a product of my culture, and what I did was morally acceptable for that culture. And so he says, yeah, it wasn't the greatest for today, but don't blame me for being someone who exploited women back in the 60s and 70s. Society was okay with it back then, so society should be okay with it now, is what Harvey Weinstein says. To which I want to respond with this. No. Stop it. Come on, man. Because what you did in the 60s and 70s was just as disgusting as 2017. But 2017 is something different. Our human consciousness as a society has developed. Because you can almost feel in all of the wave of sexual harassment and allegations and sexual assault and misconduct from powerful men has been this kind of cultural waking up in 2017, hasn't it? It's almost like we've looked around and in 2017, we as America have said, you know, powerful men who demand sexual favors from women in exchange for promotions or work should not be in power. And in 2016, we knew it was bad, but we refused to draw lines in the sand. As opposed to 2017, we're starting to wake up and saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't do this anymore. And no matter how hard we try, there's no way we can go back to 2016 where we can say, like, well, you know, maybe it wasn't that bad what Harvey Weinstein did. No, it's bad. It's terrible. It is a sin, right? And in 2017 and beyond, there's no way we can go back because we know as a society that it's wrong. And we as a society have for too long allowed this behavior to happen. And we're now coming to the point where we're waking up and saying, powerful men who do this shouldn't be powerful anymore. And it's here that I read the passage in Hebrews where this author writes, "For if we willfully persist in sin after having received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful prospect of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. I can only come up with the fact that this is, in fact, good news. This is good news. Why? Because it shows that what we're doing here in 2017 and holding powerful men accountable is where Christianity actually happens. There's this temptation that we always believe that Christianity is from long ago. But what the author is saying is, like, when we wake up and become aware of sins that we tolerated before, it is our responsibility to not tolerate those sins anymore. Specifically, the exploitation of women by powerful men. In 2017, we can't just say, you know, what Harvey Weinstein did wasn't that bad. We can't. It's impossible. Christianity happens right here, right now, in 2017. And the fact is, our developing consciousness has grown to the point where we will no longer tolerate this behavior. This idea was accentuated by a man named Ta-Nehisi Coates, who is one of our greatest authors in America. He was being interviewed by Bill Simmons on his podcast, and Bill Simmons started lamenting about how depressed he was about politics because nothing was going to change, and he just felt like it was a terrible, terrible place for America to be. He said to Ta-Nehisi Coates, "I am depressed," to which Coates responded, "I always tell people there's nothing to be depressed about. Life is always a problem. It's always filled with challenges. It's always filled with things that are irreconcilable in the moment that can't be resolved in the moment." And then he says, "That's natural for the human condition." We in 2017 are facing new realities that we did not know about in 2016. And the good news of Hebrews is that when we make decisions about things that are happening right now and we are aware of new realities and what sin was before us, the good news says that's where Christianity happens. It is Christianity's responsibility to take a stand against powerful men. And when you look at the life of Jesus, the person he was consistently angry with throughout his life were those who abused power. Christianity happens right here, right now. Which brings us to the last part of this passage that I want us to focus on. In Hebrews 10, 26, 27, we read these words, "For if we willfully persist in sin after having received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful prospect of judgment." Not only that, but you go to the last sentence of this paragraph, this fearful paragraph, and we read these words, "It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of a living God." These two verses, which use the word fearful, are in fact good news. And to explain how they are good news, I would like to tell you a parable written by the man named Peter Rollins. The parable is entitled The Payoff, and it goes like this. There once was a priest who lived in the countryside, and he was well loved by the villagers who lived around him. And these villagers would often go to the priest and ask him questions about how to live and who to be, because they respected the priest for who he was. But this countryside was ruled by a city. And in the city was a powerful prince who had risen to power because he was simply born into it. And as the prince continued to grow, he became more and more aware that he was unpopular among his people. But he took great comfort in the fact that most people who were in power weren't popular with the people. Until he came across a priest in the countryside, the same priest who was respected and loved by the people of the village who were close to him. And the prince looked at this priest living among these villagers, and he asked himself the question, why do these people that are in the village love this priest so much? Why do they respect him and ask for his advice and ask him how to live? Why don't they ask me as their ruler, as their prince, how they should live? Because I would love to tell them. And so the prince began to watch this priest and the way the priest moved and interacted with people, and he said he didn't get it because the priest was poor. The priest didn't have any power, didn't have any status, and yet people wanted to live like the priest. And so the prince began to become jealous of the priest. And he became so jealous, in fact, that he decided to confront the priest about his popularity. And so the prince, under the cover of darkness, went to the priest, knocked on the door, and the priest welcomed him in. And it was here that the prince revealed a plan to the priest. He wanted to expose the priest so that people would stop listening to him. So the prince said to the priest, for 10,000 rupees, would you write a letter to be dispersed throughout the kingdom in telegrams and newspapers informing people that you are nothing but a liar and a hypocrite? Now the priest thought about this, and he responded by saying these words. He said, well, 10,000 rupees is a great deal of money, and I am but a poor man. You will have to give me time to raise it. And that is the end of the payoff. What's brilliant about this story is that the prince offers 10,000 rupees for the priest to offer a confession that he is a hypocrite and a liar. And the priest doesn't read it as a confession. He reads it as an honor. An honor to tell people that he is a phony, that he is a hypocrite, that he does fall short of the glory of God. And the prince threatens that everyone will find out all of the shortcomings of the priest, to which the priest says, I want them to find out my shortcomings. Why? Because the minute they find out that I'm more human, that I make mistakes, that I mess things up, the more I'm allowed to point beyond my life to a living God. Because faith has a way of working and testifying and moving within weakness, doesn't it? Have you ever listened to a speaker and the speaker tells a story in which the speaker is always the hero? Or the speaker likes to tell you about how he got it right over and over and over again? Does it ever just grind your gears when you hear somebody stand up in front of a group, a congregation, an audience, and just tell you about how great they are? And how you need to understand how great they are? How different is it when somebody walks up onto a stage, grabs a microphone, and in a soft voice says these words, hi everyone, my name is Craig, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to tell you how God has spoken to me in my life in the midst of my struggle to keep drowning my soul in alcohol. Now that's a whole different conversation, isn't it? Why? Because it's honest. It's real. It cuts through the superficial. And whenever somebody stands up and owns their shortcomings, they're able to talk about faith. And what all human beings have found at some point in their life is that they were told that if they just had more faith, then everything would fall into place. But all of us know it doesn't work that way. Faith meets us in our brokenness, in our weakness, in our uncertainties, in the times that we say, you know, my pride got in the way of me loving my wife. You know, my greed got in the way of me seeing other people. I was more concerned with making money than being compassionate. And especially in 2017, when somebody stands up and says, you know, I was deceitful before, I lied before, and I can understand if you would never trust another thing that I said, rather than doubling down and telling another lie to protect the lie before. I bring all this up because when we read about a fearful prospect of judgment or the idea that it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God, my only response to this is, of course it is. Of course it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Because this God sees me for all of my strengths and my weaknesses. This God sees me for all of my triumphs and my failures. I can't lie to this God and have her believe it. I can't tell this God that I'm not greedy and I don't struggle with it because this God knows better. If I were to say to God, you know, God, I've never struggled with pride, God would look at me and say, you know, Craig, you are one terrible liar. Because this God knows. Why? Because this God has already judged me. All of the lights are on and there's nowhere to hide. And people of faith know that when there's nowhere to hide, you can be honest about your shortcomings and your failures and the temptations and what you're susceptible to. And once you're honest about those shortcomings, then you can have the courage to change things. But if you're never honest with yourself and with God, if you're always making excuses, if you're always saying like, well, I'm so great, I don't need to change, then what exactly is your testimony? Because a Christian is always trying to change, always trying to grow. And when we talk about it as a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God, of course it is, because this God sees you and sees me for who we really are. And there's parts of us that are great, and there are other parts that are not so great. And this is good news. Because it's here that we can stop pretending. And it's here we can finally be honest. And once we're honest, we can change things. The good news of Hebrews chapter 10, even though it's drenched in fearful words, is this. The judgment of God is complete and total honesty designed to inspire personal change. Christianity is not a religion where you look at other people and say, they are the problem. Christianity is always rooted in an inward personal journey in which you say, how is God asking me to grow, asking me to change, asking me to be more in this situation? If that sounds difficult and complex and hard to do, I would say, yes, it is. But the testimony of the Christian church is this. It's worth it. It's worth it. God sees us for who we are in the totality of the human experience. And God loves us and inspires us to change and grow and become more compassionate. My brothers and sisters, may you see and embrace the inspiration in all.